Today's mailbag comes to us from Melinda. Hi, Lisa. I have to tell you something. I use my portable Sunday basket as my purse. It's quite the conversation starter. I have a hypothyroid, so on a regular basis, I go and get my blood checked. Well, the last time I went, the technician asked me about it. I explained to her what it was. I explained to her how the Sunday basket worked, and she was so interested that she took down all the information and looked it up. I'm sure she has already signed up for the Sunday basket now, and probably even the Productive Home Solution. I just wish I had taken down her name. Helping people is what we love to do. And I also have to tell you that my husband is thrilled with all the decluttering, cleaning, and organizing that I've done in the kitchen so far. I even convinced him to put some special racks together for my stuff, so I have an extra 10 pounds on it. And I got that idea from one of the ladies in the 100-day home organization community group. I have to go back and find her message because I want to thank her for sharing that great idea on how to use the stackable racks to create space under her stove to place the pots and pans. I also saw the spice carousel that you suggested, and I ordered through your Amazon store. I can already see the time organizing is saving me because I know exactly where everything is that I have decluttered. I can see what I need, and when things have a spot, you can put them back in that spot and it's automatic. And just reaching for what you need, it's wonderful again. Thank you so much. Do you have an Organized 365 success story? If so, we would love to hear about it. Please send us an email at customerservice@organized365 and tell us how you have taken back your home, your paper, and your life with Organized 365.
Welcome to the Organized 365 podcast. I'm your host, professional organizer, productivity expert, and motivational speaker, Lisa Woodruff. This podcast will help you embrace progress over perfection and create lasting functional organizing in your home. I have so much to share with you, so let's get started. Last summer, as I was gallivanting around the United States, meeting you, hugging you, traveling for 6 weeks straight, Melinda met me in Illinois, and she told me about the book, The Secret History of Home Economics. I thought it had been around for a while, but now I know it had just come out. And I was traveling, and I love audiobooks. I was like, that sounds interesting. So I downloaded it, and I started listening. Oh my goodness. I was traveling, so I didn't have all my normal note-taking paraphernalia. I didn't have a physical copy of the book. I could not listen to this book fast enough. I then bought the book, and it's taken me a while to really digest everything that is inside, all of the thoughts that I have. It is like you were doing a jigsaw puzzle and all of a sudden you got the picture of what you were creating. So in the next couple of podcast episodes, I'm going to talk about, one, my family of origin and why this book was so impactful for me and how I understand it based on actual real humans in my family that I know were living through these different changes and how women were viewed both in the home and in colleges and in society. And then I'm going to dive into the details of the book, and then I'm going to pull it all together in a final podcast about where that leaves me. So first, if you would just give me the latitude to share with you in this podcast episode a little bit more about my family of origin history, it will make the next podcast episode make more sense if you're listening to it from my point of view. And you could skip this podcast entirely if you don't care about Lisa Woodruff and her history. But I encourage you, as a human, to always think about what is your point of view when you are learning something new. What is your family of origin? What is your personal experience? What is your worldview? Like just all of these things really come into play when you're looking at anything. And also, when you look back in history, we have the luxury of looking at things that happened in history with the knowledge that we have today. And the people who are going through those experiences in the past did not have the access to information that we have today, the understanding of what we have today, all of those things that we have today. So I find that I have a unique dichotomy in the family of origin that I have. I have my dad, who is the oldest of six children, whose mother was one of six children, whose mother was one of 11, and I think her father was one of 12, like huge, big Irish Catholic family that immigrated over to the United States in the early 1900s. What's also interesting about my dad's family, and I don't usually talk about my dad's family a lot because they died really young. So my dad's dad was one of only two children. I never met my uncle. My dad's dad died when I was 13 at the age of 62, and I never met his mom and dad. His dad died at 50, and there's literally no information about my dad's dad's mom. Like, we know her name. We don't even know when she was born or when she died or anything about her. I don't know anything about my dad's dad's brother. Like, that side of the family, we know almost nothing about, or at least I know nothing about. Now, my dad's mom's family, I know a lot about my dad's mom's family, even though his mom died at the age of, I believe, 43. I was 7 when she died. 43, 47. She had to have been older than 47. I don't know. 50? She was young. She was young when she died, but her mom and dad lived very old. So my dad's mom's parents lived to be 95 and 103. So that is the grandmother from Ireland that I talk about was 103. When she passed away, she had six children, 28 grandchildren, and 49 great-grandchildren. And I was the oldest of those 49 great-grandchildren. So she immigrated from Ireland in the early 1900s. And whenever you would go over to great-grandma's house, like literally there was not enough room to sit. All of the children sat on the floor. Most of my aunts and uncles sat on the floor. There weren't that many chairs. Like every place you went in that house, it wasn't a tiny house either. I mean, it was a normal size house. There were just people everywhere. You couldn't walk without bumping into people, sitting on people. Normally, everyone under the age of 18 was down in the basement unless you were coming up for cookies and soda pop, which she would give you. Grandma was usually in the back room beating you at a game of Chinese checkers. There were people in that house everywhere. So much talking, so much laughing, so much love. Same in my dad's family's house. Even though his mom and dad had died at a young age, he and his siblings still to this day, I mean, there's just people everywhere. Whenever we get together, there are just people and babies. And we were taking Grayson over to my cousin's house, and I was starting to do mental gymnastics. I'm like, all right, so this is my cousin, so it's your first cousin once removed, which makes it Grayson's second cousin, or is it a first cousin twice removed? And then their kids, oh, their kids, they're your second cousins. And I'm like doing like calculus in genealogy, just trying to figure out how everybody is related, because there are so many people in so few generations, like just so many people everywhere you go. I learned so much in my dad's family about big families and just love, just experiencing love as soon as you walk in the door. Now, my mom's family is almost completely the opposite. My mom's family immigrated to the United States before the United States was even a country. So our genealogy is traced all the way back to the daughters of the American Revolutionary War. There's a house out in New England that I haven't seen yet that is part of our family. We were never in politics, but they were landowners, farmers, accountants, business owners. And so there is a rich heritage, but not very many kids. And the people in my mom's family, the women lived a long, long time. Men, not so long, but the women lived a long, long time. And as I was reflecting on this over the last couple months, because I've been thinking a long time about these podcast episodes that I want to record for you in the next couple of weeks, why is it I know so much more about the women in my mom's family than I do of anyone else? And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One, I usually hung around the women instead of the men. But secondarily, the men passed away at pretty young ages, so they weren't even there for me to do my little inquisitory questions that I always have of everything. And the women were always available to talk and wanted to give you that information and educate you. So in my mom's family, she was the oldest of two children. Now, by remarriage, she has three other siblings. One passed away when I was younger, but I have two aunts and uncles on that family that are from remarriage, which happened before I was even born. So it never felt like my mom was the oldest of two children. It felt like my mom was in a large family, like my dad's family. But no, that wasn't the case. My mom was the oldest of two kids. And her father passed away at the age of 47 when she was in college. So her mom got remarried before I was born. So I never knew my mom's dad. And my mom's dad's dad also passed away young. Now my mom's dad's mom was alive until I was 2 years old. Her name was Ducky. My dad's mom's name was Love. That was her grandma name, was Love. I named my dad's mom because I was the first grandchild. And she would always say, come here, Love. And so I called her Love. And my mom's dad's mom name was Ducky. And my mom loved Grandma Ducky. And so my grandma name, Lovey, is a combination of my mom's dad's mom's grandma name and my dad's mom's grandma name. So a combination of Love and Ducky is Lovey. We don't know if it'll stick because Grayson isn't talking yet, but we'll see. So that was my mom's dad's side of the family. He had passed before I was born. Ducky passed by the age I was two. The only stories I really know of my dad's mom was just how much fun she was when my mom would go over there and hang out. But I don't know very much about my mom's dad and his parents, other than my mom's dad was an accountant, and I believe his father was also an accountant, so they were good in math. Now, my mom's mom was also an only child, and she lived to be 92 or 94. I can't remember. She passed away about 5 or 6 years ago. And I'll get back to grandma in a minute. But her mom and dad both lived for a long time. My mom's mom's mom, my great-grandma, was an only child, and my mom's mom's dad was an only child. You could see, like, it's amazing that this family has made it this far in lineage because they didn't have a lot of kids. I cannot believe that their family tree was so intact. And it's because they lived so long. Like, my mom's family has a lot of longevity in them. So my mom's mom lived to be 92 or 94. Her mother lived to be 90. And my mom's mom's dad lived to be 83. He was a dentist. Now, when I was 13, in eighth grade, I had three grandfathers die within 4 weeks. And those grandfathers were my dad's dad, my dad's mom's dad, and my mom's mom's dad. All died within 3 or 4 weeks in April of 1985, which left me with just grandmas. So all I had left were grandmas then growing up for my high school and college years, and I still had a couple of them. And my mom and her mom were all very into personal and professional development, education, bettering themselves, very much doers. They did not do a lot of sitting. Like when I go over to my dad's family's house, we sit down, we have tea, and we talk for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. When I go to my mom's family's house, they're cooking, they're cleaning, they're puzzling, they're knitting, they're crafting, they're doing something. We're still talking. But while we're talking, we are also industrious. We are doing and creating something. It doesn't even matter if we're doing the puzzle and taking the puzzle apart when we're done. Like, we are doing things. I am very much that person. I can sit and talk. Like, I love to sit and talk, especially if there's an agenda. But also, if I could be knitting or doing a puzzle or crafting while we're doing it, all the better because I'm multitasking and I love it. So my mom's family is very doer-focused, always has something going on or multiple things going on, and they're very good at it. So my great-grandmother was born in 1901. I'd written this down, and now I can't find that paper that I brought in. And she lived in the area of Kent, upper, like the outside of the Akron, Ohio area is where this family was and where all their farms were. So my great-grandfather, I told you, was a dentist. Again, I don't know much about his college, but I know my great-grandmother went to Kent State Normal School. Now, I was rereading my scrapbooks that my mom did for me like 20 years ago. I was so grateful. And I reread a little bit more about my great-grandmother. Her name was Therese. And she grew up in Streetsboro. And in her high school class, there were only four students. There were only four students in her high school class. And then she went on to college. She went to Kent State Normal School. My grandmother, Charlotte, my mom's mom, also went to Kent State. And at that time, it was not called normal school. So I did a little bit of research. So let me tell you about Kent State. So Kent State actually became a normal school in 1910. And this was during the Progressive Era. I'm reading from the Kent State website now. During the Progressive Era, reformers were placing increasing emphasis on education. Many teachers did not have advanced training, and normal schools were open to provide training and professional development for teachers. Kent State was one of several institutions of this kind supported by the state of Ohio during this era. Next podcast, when we start talking about the history of home economics, they mention this. So Kent State started in 1910 as a normal school, which meant that women were allowed to be admitted for the purpose of becoming a teacher. So my great-grandmother did become a teacher. Kent State then, in 1929, was renamed to Kent State College, and that's when they were allowed to offer other programs of study beyond education. That's when my grandmother Charlotte went to Kent State as well. When she went, it was Kent State College. She got a degree in home economics. See, I mean, full circle. After that, in 1935, Kent State began to offer graduate courses, and then it became Kent State University. So Kent State was a normal school, then it became a college, then it became a university. Actually, I believe my grandma was probably there when it was a university. So when my great-grandmother went there, she probably was one of those very first Kent State Normal School College classmates, and she got a degree as a teacher. I don't remember any stories of my great-grandmother ever being a teacher. She did own a floral shop. She owned a restaurant, and there was another business that she had. She was very much an entrepreneur, but the only college that was available to her was to get this teacher degree through a normal school. Then, you know, 20 years later, when my grandmother went through, Charlotte went through Kent State, she got a home economics degree. Now, my grandmother, Charlotte, was married to my mom's dad, obviously, who was an accountant, and he died very young. And so my grandmother took over my grandfather's accounting practice, you know, just kind of like was keeping the books. And that's how she met the grandfather I know, because he was a client of my mom's dad. And Grandpa Fitzmyer, who was my grandpa, he was an engineer. So that is the history of my mom's family as far as education. When my mom was getting ready to go to college, she went to Purdue University. She got an art degree and she was an art teacher. Again, she did not practice as an art teacher. When I went to college, I went to Miami University and I got a degree in family and consumer sciences, which is what they called early childhood education then, along with a elementary education on top of that. So this really gives you a foundation for my understanding of education. As a fourth generation female college educated woman, that is like so rare. And the only reason that I have that much college education when I look back on it in my lineage is because the family that got college educated was so small. They were able to concentrate their wealth in just those, you know, basically one child. Until you got to my mom, there was one child. Oh, now there are two children. And there was always, always this constant focus on bettering yourself, becoming educated, understanding how the world worked, and being a contributing member of society. So in addition to college and running these different businesses, my great-grandmother, my grandmother, my mother all ran businesses from home, either in conjunction with their spouses or in their own right, like my mother. So I'll just reiterate, when I was in second grade, my mom started a business out of our basement. She went to New York, bought clothing, and then started shipping it in cases around the United States where women would have these home shows in their house during the week and then ship those clothes to the next person in line and take orders. And then we would fill those orders in Akron and send those out. She sold that business in 1985. It was called The Fine Line at that time. So I literally watched her create a business, build a business, and sell a business when I was in grade school. And she sold the business because she wanted to be able to spend more time with my sister and I because she felt that her role as a parent was to really educate us and give us all the experiences possible before we became out on our own and had our own families. Some of the things that I was able to experience as a child are much more remarkable, I feel, even than the college education that I was so blessed to receive. So some of those were my grandma and grandpa, when they retired, they got a motorhome and they started traveling around the United States. And before they did that, they had been traveling in Europe. And I love to hear the stories of what they did. And my mom also loves to travel. And my mom, grandma, and I all love conferences. Like, it pretty much doesn't even matter what the conference is. I'm going to want to attend it and I'm going to take notes. Like, I just love, love, love learning. So grandma and my mom and my sister and I traveled out to Washington, D.C. because my uncle was in the Pentagon at the time and my cousins were out there. And so we got to see them. We also got to tour Washington, D.C. I've been there 9 times, but who's counting? I love, love, love Washington, D.C. And on our way out there, we stopped at Williamsburg and we saw the presidential homes in Virginia. You know, many people do this trip. However, when you do the trip, you probably aren't doing it with Zig Ziglar playing in the car and the discussions that happen in the car in between each stop. Like, we were not playing the license plate game. We were playing like these high intellect discussion games. And I love it. Like, I love it. And I'm researching the history of everything. And I love experiential learning. Like, when you know your family history and you know history of your friends, it just makes all of the real world events that we're talking about now so much richer and deeper. I have really enjoyed over the last couple of years diving into private discussions with people that I've met by coincidence and people I've known for a long time, asking questions about their family of origin and what was your house like growing up, and then your grandparents and your opportunities to receive education, and how did you spend your free time? And let me just tell you, some people are not receptive to that many questions. It seems like the Spanish Inquisition. It really isn't. I'm just interested. And when I can find someone that has a more diverse background than the one that I am familiar with, I have even more questions. And when I can find people that are willing to listen and answer my questions from the spirit of just being inquisitive and wanting to know so I can better understand versus feeling like they have to justify or explain. Oh, it is such a rich conversation. And I've had some of those this year that have really helped expand my knowledge of what it's like to not have a lot of the advantages that I've had as a child that comes from only 2 children, from a family that has a lot of education and a lot of history of being in the United States. So in those high school years, especially when my mom sold her business and really basically homeschooled us while also sending us to school. So we went to school, but when we weren't in school, my mom used every opportunity to enrich our lives, to give us as many educational opportunities before we went out on our own. Sometimes they were not well received. Let me just tell you this. When you go to Walt Disney World and you stay there for a week and your mom enrolls you in art classes, you tend to give her a little bit of lip about that. Like, we are at Walt Disney World and you just put me in school. However, I learned a lot. Like, I know how they do a lot of the art in Disney and I know how to draw Mickey Mouse. And what's interesting is in the last year or just in the last couple of months, the state of Florida has said that Walt Disney World is going to lose its privilege of being its own city. So Walt Disney bought enough land in Florida that they could create their own building codes and ordinances that are separate than everybody else in Florida. There are other areas that have done this too in Florida, like the Villages and things like that. I'm not going to get into all the politics of it because, frankly, I haven't even listened and I don't really understand. All I heard from the little clip that I heard from the radio was that Walt Disney World is going to lose this privilege of being able to set their own building code ordinances and all of the other things that they've been able to do. Now, for that privilege, they also have paid for all of their own utilities and their own emergency medical services and all of those things. But because when I was a nerd and I was 13 and I was in class down at Walt Disney World, I have this weird knowledge that the reason why that was so great for Walt Disney is because they were able to build some of these things like the railroad ride that you ride. That mountain is not made out of cement. It's made out of like a fiberglass or something that would not have met building codes in other areas, but did because they made their own building codes. That's not the exact thing. I'm remembering from when I'm 13. Do your own research, but you understand what I'm saying. So because my parents would sign me up for literally, and by my parents, I mean my mother, because my dad was like, let's go to the park. Let's play golf. Let's go out to dinner. My mom was like, no, they're going to be educated. They're going to go to this class. They're going to learn this thing. He's like, okay, whatever you want to do. I have such a vast amount of random information in my brain. I have so much. So here's another thing that my parents afforded me, which was amazing. When I was in high school, I was part of the Dwight D. Eisenhower People-to-People Exchange Program. This is the thing, you guys. So Dwight D. Eisenhower, and I have printed this out, the People-to-People International Travel Program still exists. And the president's vision was to break the cycle of fear and misunderstanding and for people to understand one another. He knew for this to be effective, it must not be sought through governments, but through the hearts of people yearning for dignity, freedom, and peace. And through People to People, you could be part of this international exchange program, basically. So when I was in high school, when I was 16, I went to 7 different countries. I was gone for 6 weeks in Europe. I just turned 16. I was the youngest student. My dad tells the story of walking through the airport back when you could walk people right to the gate. He's like, oh, we love you, Lisa. You know, like, we're really going to miss you. And I was like, okay. And I turned and I like walked on the jet bridge, walked on the airplane. Off I go for 6 weeks. He's like, you didn't even turn around and wave or anything. You were just like on a mission. Off you went. I was like, sounds like me. So we went to 7 countries, one of which was an Iron Curtain country, because back then there was the Cold War was going on. And so there were countries that you could not visit. Although now, again, there are countries you cannot visit, but for a while there were. And so I went to Czechoslovakia before it was a free country. I went to Portugal, Spain, France. We landed in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. And it was fabulous. And in 3 of those countries, I spent 5 days with a family. And I got to learn, you know, I was in a Spanish apartment. I was in an Austrian house, a little bit like a suburban house. And in France, I was in a farmhouse in the country. And so I got to live in those experiences. I got to see a lot of places. And then because it was a government-sponsored exchange program, when we went to DC, we actually had a meeting in, I cannot remember where we met, in Washington, D.C. We did not have any formal things like that when we went to Europe. Now, fast forward a little bit. When I was in college, the end of my 2nd year in college, going into my junior year, I was invited to be part of an exchange program through People to People in Beijing for education. And I still to this day do not know how or why I got invited to be there. Everyone else that was on this trip either owned a daycare center or they were like a principal of a school or something like that, because it was an international exchange between the U.S. and China. And we went over and we got to see all the elementary schools and their kindergartens. And then the next year, they got to come over to the United States and do the same thing. Everyone was like 30-year-old plus, and I was 22. I don't know how I even got invited, but because my parents had the means and my mom hasn't met a conference she didn't want to go to, she said, you can go, but only if I can go too. So she came with me and we went to China. It was great. So I got to actually have a meeting in the Great Hall of the People. So that's how you know it was actually a government exchange. We had this big meeting in that formal hall, which was amazing. And then I got to see a couple of different Chinese schools. And that's why I know in China that children actually go to school like Sunday night and they stay there until the next Saturday because it's so far to send kids there and they sleep there and they have school there. And that's where I saw the international school, which was a Montessori school. And I was like, ooh, I like Montessori. And I was already in college and Miami didn't have a Montessori program, but later I did go and I got a degree in Montessori education as well. Now, while I was at college, I was getting a degree in family and consumer sciences. And really, I didn't care what they called it. I just wanted to play with babies, teach babies, possibly have a daycare center, have babies of my own. Did I mention that I liked babies? And one of the coolest things that we had at Miami University was we had this lab school. It was basically like a preschool on campus. And so it was right across the street from the school where we had most of our classes. It was just this little building. And you went in there, it was a preschool. And there was a 2-way mirror so you could watch the kids, so you could do your observations for your classes. And then as you got through your schooling, you got to go in and actually teach classes or teach lessons to the kids, but you could do a lot of observation. Really, 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 really cool. I loved it. Again, I didn't know about Montessori. A lot of Montessori schools are set up that way, but that was not my understanding. So growing up, I had a lot of diverse experiences, education related, that were not inside of a school. And additionally, I had great school experiences. When I went to college, I went to school every summer. I went to summer school the first year in Akron so I could take some math class that I still don't think I passed, which then moved me out of getting a, you know, a business degree because that wasn't going to happen. But because I took so many classes, by the time I graduated, I had 2 degrees. I had one in this family and consumer sciences, which was to teach children birth through the age of 5. And then I had a 1st through 8th grade elementary degree. And then the summer after I graduated, I took 3 more classes, which gave me my kindergarten endorsement, which meant I could teach anything from 0 to 8th grade. And so when I got my first job, I immediately got 2 pay raises because I had like 165 hours. They're like, how did you even get this many hours? I was like, I don't know. Is that a lot? They're like, it's a lot. I was like, oh, okay. I don't know what to tell you. I just love learning. So I love learning. And now in the next podcast, I'm going to talk to you about the history of home economics, which blew my mind. Oh, there's one more thing I have to tell you today that I'm going to tell you in the next one. Okay, so another thing that I did in the summer, so I had that summer where I went to Europe, and we had that summer where we traveled out to DC and we got to see all that about American history. The other summers that I didn't do that, and there were probably 2 or 3, we went to this place called Chautauqua in New York. It's like a summer institute for adults. It's like school for adults, basically what it is. And then, of course, Emily and I are there. There are like hardly any kids there, but Emily and I are there. It's like summer camp. And my mom's friend had a house there. She had a condo there. So she already had a place there, and she would spend her whole summers there. They had a boat. There is a lake. I think we went on the boat twice. That wasn't why we went. It was like going back into the 1950s. So this would have been like the late 80s. And when you drive into Lake Chautauqua, you're allowed to drive your car in for 1 hour and unpack it. And then you have to go park it somewhere else. And there are no cars in there. You ride your bikes everywhere. You go up to the like town square. They show a movie. There was an ice cream shop. Of course, I found people to babysit their little kids. But it's an institute. Like, it's where you take classes. And I remember... You guys, I'm such a nerd. I remember being so excited. Like, what classes am I going to take? This is not child camp, you guys. This is an adult institute of learning. So I'm taking classes about art with other adults. I'm taking classes about psychology, like whatever I wanted. My mom was like, yep, you could take that class. Yep. And you had to pay for these classes. Like, I want this one. I want this one. I sang with the choir in their amphitheater. I saw the Air Supply concert came there. I saw Air Supply. I went and got their newsletter and read it each week. Like, I loved it. It was almost like you had this independence. Like, you just were allowed to do a lot because you were in this little, like, gated community with no cars. So mom didn't worry you were going to get hit by a car. Plus, Emily and I were allowed a lot of freedom within reason. Like, we were good kids. So we were allowed to say, hey, I'm going to be gone for now. I'm going to go ride my bike up to the square. My mom was like, fine, have fun. She was like listening to some conference on radio or going over to talk to her friend or reading a book, or like she was learning. I could learn. I could do whatever I wanted. So I know we did this 2 summers, maybe 3. And I know when I went off to college, my mom was still going to Lake Chautauqua with my sister. And we would get a condo, apartment, condo, I don't know. You came in, my mom had a bedroom on the first floor, and then there was like a family area, and then there was a small kitchen. And then in the family room above that was a loft. And that's where my sister and I would sleep on sleeping bags all summer. We just totally loved it. We pretended, I think we were off to college or camp or something. So Lake Chautauqua was really, really fun. None of my friends had that kind of experience nor wanted to hear me talk about it. But all this becomes relevant next week when we talk about the history of home economics. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I certainly have enjoyed going back through my past history, the things that make me uniquely me. And that's what's so fun, you guys, about scrapbooks. I know not everybody wants to do a scrapbook, but my great-grandmothers have been gone for quite a while, and I was able this weekend to pull out these scrapbooks and read about their stories again. So even if you don't make a scrapbook, record your family story. tell your kids or your siblings or ask your parents questions or your grandparents, like whoever is still around when you are talking to them this summer or over the rest of the year, like ask them questions about your history so that you could pass it on to the next generation. Because when we learn about the history of our collective society, it's helpful to know our unique history and how it plugs into that story. The series that we're in right now, where I explore the secret history of home economics, both the book and my own personal family history of women getting a college degree in home economics. And actually, that's what my college degree in as well. I am amazed and frankly astounded at how different home economics was viewed in the 1800s and the early 1900s, how that changed in the 1940s, and how now, again today, in the 2020s, we're starting to go back to that original view of how important it is to have a good foundation at home, that there is an economy that is happening at home, that there is work to be done at home, and that work is valuable and it is important. And I'm so excited that over the last 10 years, Organize 365 has really worked hard at figuring out what is the work that needs to be done? What is housework? What is the definition of organization? How can we eliminate Swiss cheese organization and actually get organized once and for all so we can live an organized life and we could be more productive? Organization is a learnable skill. 87% of those surveyed in Organize 365 surveys agree. Organization is a learnable skill. I have a degree in home economics and education, and I love teaching. I can teach you the skill of home organization, reducing the amount of housework that you do and making the invisible work that is done at home visible. I'd love for you to join us in learning how to learn the skill of getting organized at home. It starts with the Sunday basket. After you've got your Sunday basket going, go all in with the productive home solution and then take that success into your work with the Friday Workbox. You can find out all of the Organize 365 products that help you learn how to get organized over at organize365.com under the program tab.